Welcome to the Faith Element Podcast for August 9, 2015, for Session 7.32, focusing on the text from 2 Samuel 18, verse 1 through 33, Terror Go Round. I'm David Cassidy, and I'm joined for this episode by Nikki Hardiman, Daniel Glaze, and Burt Montgomery. Daniel, can you please give us an introduction to today's focal passage?
I'd be happy to. Thanks, David. We continue the David saga that we've been discussing for the last couple of weeks, and this section of 2 Samuel continues that violent and tragic story. You may recall that we've discussed in our previous lessons and podcasts how David was watching Bathsheba bathe on a roof one evening. He calls her to him, and he sleeps with her. He then has her Bathsheba's husband killed so he can marry her and add her to his collection of wives. Their first son, the son of Bathsheba and David, dies in infancy, and it's just tragedy all around. So today's story picks up when another one of David's sons, Absalom, is leading a revolt against his father's army in order to take over the new kingdom, or just take over the kingdom. And in one of what we might call tragically tender moments, David says to his officers, if you catch him, that is my son, you know, if you catch Absalom, go easy on the boy. In the later scene, Absalom is riding his mule to go meet his father's army, and in sort of a bizarre scene, his hair or his head apparently gets stuck in a tree as he's riding his mule. The messengers give this news to David, and he of course weeps bitterly for his son, and expresses his desire that he could have died in his place, and that's how this passage ends.
You know, I just want to jump in and say that when I was in my 20s, I had really, really long hair, and my family members would quote that to me as a reason why Christians shouldn't have long hair. Look what happened to Absalom.
Oh.
Boy, that's proof texting 101, isn't it?
There we go. Beware.
I notice you have shorter hair now.
I just said, as long as I'm not out to kill my dad, I'm okay. So I love how you gave a sort of a background to Absalom. And I just want, if I can, share a brief quote from Frederick Buechner. I love the way he describes Absalom. Buechner says, almost from the start, Absalom had a number of strikes against him. For one thing, he was much too handsome for his own good. His special pride was such a magnificent head of hair that once a year he had it trimmed, and the trimmings alone tipped the scales at 3.5 pounds. And for another thing, his father, King David, was always either spoiling him rotten or reading him the Riot Act. And this did not promote the stability of character. And I think that's a great description of what we've got going on here.
When I get to this point in the David story, I just find myself really sad. David, who had so much promise, who is remembered well, he had so much tragedy in his life. A great deal of it his own making. But I just find myself feeling really sad for David and David's family. And I guess I wonder if he ever regrets taking the path that he took. Does he regret that Samuel showed up that day and anointed his head with oil, that he was chosen even though he was the youngest one of all of his brothers? I wonder if he ever thinks back to, what if I'd just stayed home? But that's not his story. It's not the story we get for David. And
well, it's not specifically stated in the story. But maybe it's just me, but you kind of get the feeling that maybe he did regret a little bit. I mean, the softness that he has toward Absalom. Please, you know, don't kill my son. I know he's coming to kill me, but don't kill him. It's my son. And then when he does die, he says, I wish I had died instead. Mm-hmm. You know, that sense of, I've screwed up so much stuff and I've passed it on to my kids, and now they're trapped in it. I mean, when I hear the David story, I get that sense of, look what I've done to my family.
And I agree. Like, I have those feelings for David and for the story. But then there's this other part of me that realizes he's talking to Joab when he says, don't kill my son. And part of me wonders, or he says, don't harm the son. And so, and when we know the story of David and Joab, Joab has taken care of quite a few of David's messes along the way. And I wonder if Joab was reading between the lines. Maybe it wasn't, don't kill my son. Maybe it was, don't let him suffer when you do what you know you have to do. You know, I find myself torn about David. I feel really sad for him when I look at his whole family experience. And then at the same time, I also know he wasn't stupid. I also know that he knew the only way to resolve this was for Absalom to die. There was no way to resolve the fact that Absalom was living in the palace, sleeping with his wives, other than to get rid of him. And so I think that deep down, David probably knew what had to happen. And I imagine that it was complex. It wasn't either or.
You know, and I'm not a scholar of Greek mythology and Greek tragedy, but the Aeschylus, the story of the Prince of Thebes about Oedipus and his two sons. Oedipus is thrown from power because of the controversy of him sleeping with his mother, which he didn't know at the time and all that stuff. So his two sons agree to switch back and forth on the throne. Eteocles, I think, and I can't think of the other one's name. Anyway, and then the first one enjoys being king so much the first year, he decides he's not going to give up his throne to his brother the second year. And so they end up killing each other. Mm-hmm. And there's just this whole mess, and Oedipus is like, I'm trying, but it's like fate is against us, and we're all doomed to repeat this. Mm-hmm. And my children are now doomed to repeat this. And Aeschylus has this set up as a tragedy that this is just fate, that everybody is doomed to repeat this horrible tragedy they're trapped in. You can't not let it play out. And that's sort of what I get what you're saying with David is it's almost like I'm trapped. It has to play itself out, and I know how it's going to have to happen.
Well, I think, I don't know, I guess... What I'm hearing a lot of here is this cycle of violence is not easy to break. That we on the one hand we think, well, it should just involve someone laying down their arms saying I'm sorry or whatever. But that so goes against and contradicts human nature that that's just not the way we operate. And I think whether it's honor killings in other parts of the world, whether it's in our own history with the Hatfields and the McCoys, it's if you fire a warning shot, then I'm gonna fire one a little bit closer, and it's rarely do we see those who rise up and say there is a better way. I'd encourage our listeners those who are teaching to, I know your time is limited, but perhaps if you could check out some of the writings of Walter Wink, and he critiques very passionately what he calls the redemptive violence myth, or the myth of redemptive violence. That is that there is some positive gain from more and more violence. And I think that may be helpful as you're teaching this lesson.
Yeah, and the old saying that Martin Luther King made famous, and people have quoted ever since, but I don't think he came up with this on his own, but, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth is going to leave the world blind, toothless, and dead. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That somehow you've got to break, you just have to stop.
Mm-hmm. And maybe, I mean, I don't want to jump straight to the New Testament, but maybe that's why Jesus gives us action steps to try to break that. Because, I mean, these things don't just fall apart naturally. When he says if someone, strikes you on one side of the cheek, we'll turn the other as well. If someone, you know, if someone makes you walk 1 mile, well, go ahead and walk another. You know, these are action steps that it takes someone to stand up in the face of such injustice and such violence and say, stop. You know, this is literally killing us.
Yeah, I like the connection to the Jesus teaching. I think that those steps that you're talking about, a lot of times they've been interpreted to be kind of like be a doormat, like mm-hmm. you should just let people walk all over you. But in fact, when you do things like that, it changes the dynamic between the two people involved. When you turn your, like, fine, hit me on the other cheek, it changes the dynamic, like, when you offer that. And I think what happens is it's an incredibly creative way to respond to a very hard situation. And I think that one of the reasons that stopping a cycle where people are hitting back and forth and back and forth is because it's hard to think creatively when you're in that fight or flight mode. It's very difficult to think outside of the box to try to come up with a different response other than just a retaliatory response.
Yeah, and that's exactly right, Nikki. I was sort of thinking of, as you were talking, Jesus's teachings on being meek. And in some ways, that's sort of a little bit of a mistranslation, I think. Mm-hmm. In our English language, we think of being meek as I think you said doormat or exhibiting weakness. But mm-hmm. if I recall the Greek word, it's also been used to connote things like powerful medicine and other things, which is power under control. And it's I've heard, you know, the Jesus's form of meekness being standing toe to toe with power and refusing to give in or refusing to flinch, not at all some sort of weak submissive, you know, cowering in fear, but standing up against a violent culture and saying we can do better here.
But it has the. And again, I'm going back to Martin Luther King Jr., who went back to Gandhi, and Gandhi got it all from Jesus. But it has the element of you being vulnerable and risking being hurt, being beaten, and dying at the hands of your oppressor to break the cycle. I'm not going to fight you back. I will stand up against you. I will speak against you. But our love is, and God's love is greater than the hate that you have and can absorb it. And much like Jesus on the cross, that the being willing to take what they're going to throw at you and not respond eye for an eye can hurt the one doing it. But in the bigger sense, it begins the cultural transformation of breaking the cycle so that... When you think of the civil rights movement and when the authorities were letting the dogs loose and turning the fire hoses and getting their billy clubs out on the nonviolent marchers, unarmed nonviolent marchers who stood there and took it instead of fighting back, they got hurt, they got beaten, some didn't survive, but the culture took that and said, wait, this has to stop. Because as long as the two sides are going at it, we all want to see what's going on. But when you see the moral high ground taken, and then the ugliness of the oppressor really comes out, the rest of the people say, okay, that's enough. And even the people in the middle of the road who didn't know what they thought about civil rights said, this is wrong. And so there's something about the meekness that does stand up, but it does lay itself down to receive the blow, if you will, because the greater transformation is not for that individual, but for the culture at large, for the world at large.
Yeah, well, this
for God's kingdom.
Right. Well, this, I mean, this, you know, the cycle of violence that we see in this David story, and it's certainly very evident in this section with Absalom. You know, as we read it, we can clearly see points at which situations can be diffused, or tempers can be put in check, or the ways things could have been done differently. We see that, we recognize it. Yet, I mean, even in our own lives and in our own culture, I think we find it incredibly difficult to be peacemakers, to act like peacemakers, mm-hmm. because it goes against what we're often taught. You know, I happen to be reading, it's been a couple weeks ago now, in the Washington Post, apparently on a website posting, there was a post by a board member of the National Rifle Association who very clearly indicated that Reverend Clemente Pinckney, the pastor of Emmanuel AME Church, was in many ways responsible for the deaths of his parishioners, because he was supportive of his church being a gun-free zone. The very clear indication was, you know, if all those people had been packing heat, you know, they'd have taken him out. And I'm not certainly anti-gun, but you know, I've often said the right to bear arms, I think, also includes the right not to bear arms, and that's where I come from. And I think, you know, why is it so difficult for us to understand that some places should be free of weapons, whether small scale or weapons of mass destruction? Why is it so hard for us to envision, you know, a place where everybody isn't walking around with, you know, concealed weapons? Why can't we bless the fact that some people in some places are trying to make pockets of peace? And I mean, it just goes against, I think, everything that we're taught. We're taught, someone hits you, you hit them back, and you hit them harder. Mm-hmm. I don't know where I'm going with that, but I find it so, it's one of those where cognitive thoughts on it and our behavioral thoughts on it are sometimes polar opposites.
Yeah. And culturally, coming from a sociological perspective, just assume for a minute that the African-American pastor or someone in the congregation had a gun and shot back. With all the racial tensions that are going on in our country right now, what would we be seeing in the media if a black man's firing back at a white guy with a gun? And would that be inflaming racial tensions that are already there? But because he did not, and because we saw God-loving, worshiping people in the fellowship of Christ, and the pastor saying, this is going to be a gun-free zone, but being the victims of a violent act by a white supremacist, the ugliness came out, much like King talks about, like a boil. It's got to show. If he had fought back, that may not have shown this way. And then all of a sudden, we're having conversations that we haven't had in 150 years about the symbols of the Confederacy and what it means.
Absolutely.
And here in Mississippi, of all places, cities are beginning to refuse to fly the state flag until we change our state flag. Cities all around Starkville's aldermen are going to vote on it Tuesday night, this coming Tuesday night. And so all around Mississippi, cities are beginning to say, take down the state flag until we change it. And that would not have happened. And we would not be having the conversations about civil war being about slavery and the oppression of other people, had he fought back with a gun. So I don't want this to be misinterpreted as it's a good thing he died. I don't want to be misinterpreted that way. Mm-mm. But that to me is the illustration of breaking the cycle of violence and willing to give up yourself. I mean, Jesus says, take up our cross, be willing to die, rather than break the violence. And look at the transformation that's occurring. And as I can't think of her name, the head of the nuns on the bus would say, the Holy Spirit is alive and well and causing mischief. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at the things that are happening and discuss hard discussions that are happening. That's the power of nonviolence to transform. But I think Jesus is talking about transforming relationships. Glenn Stassen was an incredible ethicist who was always talking about just peacemaking and nonviolence as a way to transform relationships. And he kind of got into the whole Sermon on the Mount and Jesus loving your enemies, turning the other cheek as a way to transform the relationship.
Bert, I think it's interesting that you don't want it to sound like you're saying it's a good thing he died. But I don't hear that at all. I actually hear the truth is that his death is really horrible, particularly because it happened because of racism and it was so violent. And I think that what I'm kind of hearing and what we're talking about is that to break cycles of violence, if you are going to be the one helping to do that, you're going to get hurt.
Yes.
I mean, I think that I think that's the reason it's so counterintuitive. I don't think it's, we might. I think the truth is when it is effective, someone is hurt. And it is often the most innocent. And when we think about, it reminds me of my best friend in the world. She helped me, her name is Jill, and she helped me kind of work through my own thoughts about the cross and what happens there. And she said she always had this idea that in the cross, when Jesus dies on the cross, for her, there's this picture and that we are beating on God as hard as we can and God doesn't hit back.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what we see with Jesus on the cross. Jesus could have swung back. Jesus could have resisted. But Jesus knew something bigger and knew that there was something bigger. And that has been very helpful for me to think about God didn't hit back. And because of that, Jesus dies on a cross. And I think that the reason talking about cycles of violence, whether we're thinking about relationships in our own lives or if we're thinking about national and global implications, it's incredibly counterintuitive because we know deep down that someone has to get hurt. It's just part of the way that it works.
Yeah, and when you're talking about cycles of violence, I was thinking that in social work and sociology, we talk about the cycle of abuse, which goes on and on and on for generations. Mm-hmm. And people talk about we've got to break the cycle of abuse. And one of the kids has to decide, I'm done hitting back. And very often they have to leave. You can't stay in that situation. Mm-hmm. Because you're going to get just wrapped back up into it somehow or other. You've got to leave. I don't know where I was going with that, but just that's what came to mind when you're talking about the cycle of violence. You know, even within our own families, the cycle mm-hmm. of abuse is that same type of thing. If I stay and I'm still a part of it, it keeps continuing. And it will continue on for the next generation, which is what we're seeing with David and Absalom and all of those. Mm-hmm. The cycle just keeps going on.
Well, to hear both of you talk, I mean, Nikki, you were talking about Christ on the cross not hitting back. And Bert, you talked about, you know, in the cycle of violence or cycle of abuse that is sometimes seen in the home. And what it takes to be able to break that cycle, to go back to a point I was earlier making, it takes action. That action may not be hitting back, which, you know, the behavior of Christ. It may not mean just staying in that situation, but there's some action behind it. Whether it's I'm not going to be part of this, I'm going to leave, or Christ on the cross not hitting back because, frankly, he had bigger things to do, and that was giving of his life and reconciling the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that message would have been overshadowed, I think, if there had been retaliatory violence.
Well, it gets to the heart of everything Jesus talks about, as you've said before, Daniel, because what's driving Absalom and what's driving Joab is it's a need, an inner need for revenge. It's hatred, it's bitterness, it's jealousy, it's mm-hmm. I've been done wrong. It's all of that stuff. And, you know, when Jesus says, oh, you think you're so great because you haven't committed murder. But if you hate someone, mm-hmm. you've committed murder in your heart. Mm-hmm. And so that inner transformation of letting go of bitterness and letting go of anger, of forgiveness, forgiving, praying for your enemies, of forgiving those who have hurt you, even if you can't see them, even if you don't get to see them face to face, even if they're long dead, being able to let it go and say, I'm not going to fight back anymore. It's done. Because as long as you're fighting back with that anger and that resentment, even if it's just emotionally on the inside, the fight and the violent cycle still goes on. You know, Nikki brought up a very interesting idea about Joab that I'd never thought about, that maybe David kind of knew and kind of, you know, don't hurt my son, but he and Joab knew well enough that Joab took that, yeah, go ahead and kill him, but kill him quickly so he doesn't hurt. I never thought of it that way. So thinking of it just the general way of David legitimately, seriously not wanting Joab to be hurt. I mean Absalom to be hurt. Joab disobeys, willingly disobeys his king
mm-hmm.
because he knows what's best. He thinks he knows what's best. Because I picture Joab saying, if I let him go, he's going to kill King David. I mean, that's all there is to it. So we're just going to do this. Even when the other men say, we heard King David, we're not going to do it. Joab has it done. And I wonder if that's how a lot of us are, that we're like Joab. And, you know, mm-hmm. we know God says, turn the other cheek. We know God says, you know, go the extra mile. We know God says, take up your cross, be willing to die, give up your life, all that kind of stuff. Love your enemies. But God, you know, when we come down to the real situations, we're, you know, and we take mm-hmm. up, we have a Christian crusade mentality in a lot of our churches and a lot of conversations within Christianity that we're going to fight for God. We're going to defend God. We're going to defend truth, even if it goes against everything God tells us and Jesus tells us, because we know better. And I kind of think that is a way of mm-hmm. maybe Joab, kind of an idea of how Joab relates to us today.
I think you're right. I think it's kind of, well, that's a nice idea, but I know how it is here in the real world. And I remember I was working with my youth one time and we were dealing with some of these issues of peace. And I was talking about the importance of being able to imagine what it would look like, that when we can imagine something, we can begin to be a part of bringing it into reality. And they just told me, they said, that'll never happen. Like, there was no ability to imagine something better because they were honestly just quite cynical about the ability to bring peace anywhere. Not just talking about world peace, but that's just not the way that it works. And that's really was the kind of what I got from them, was that's not how it works in the real world.
So can the inner hippie in me just say what you're saying is John Lennon was right? Imagine, right?
Right.
Well, thank you, Bert, Daniel, and Nikki for another invigorating conversation. This was a tough one.
Mm-hmm.
But thanks for your insights, and I look forward to talking with you next week.
Thank you, David.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Find more information about this podcast, as well as videos and teaching resources for this session, at faithelement.net. Subscribe to the Faith Element podcast on iTunes. Faith Element is a service of Faith Lab.